You're listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh, boy.
Large wedge tornado coming up in 2 hours.
A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
Just now we can expect at least another 2 to 4 inches overnight.
Good Thursday evening. Thank you for joining us here on the Weather Junkies. I'm Tyler Jankowski in Connecticut. It is Thursday, October 20th. So we are a third of the way through the month of October. We are live on this Thursday evening, and Dakota is joining us from Colorado.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight. Yeah, it's another pretty nice day in Fort Collins. We actually had our first frost. Actually, I think it was our first freeze, too, in Fort Collins and across the Front Range. So Carr, a little bit of frost on it this morning. So that was kind of interesting. Tyler, I think you're getting some rain on the way. Is that correct?
Yeah, it seems like an annoyance type rain. Probably we don't come out of it with more than a tenth or 2/10 of an inch. So we really need the rain, and it's a day or two of gloomy weather, but not very much of a strong indication for a lot of rain. I know New York up near Syracuse and maybe out to the east in Rhode Island or Cape Cod will get a hefty amount, but I don't think so for Connecticut. So not much in the way of drought relief. And speaking of frosts and freezes, I'm pretty sure the growing season has ended here, at least in my town. I think it's ended across most of Connecticut. But I just picked the three best tomatoes of the season 2 hours ago. So
there you go.
That was pretty cool. And then there's talk of snow in northern New England before the weekend is out.
I saw that.
Not really here. I mean, it would be like our stray snowflake, but it'll be windy this weekend behind that storm.
Yeah. And I saw there's a tornado threat
in central Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. Not cool, but you know, it's interesting this time of the year. Not crazy unusual, but it I don't know.
Yeah, when's the so-called second severe weather season? Not that it applies to us, but it's the fall, right? I mean, you have your two seasons of transition, spring and fall. So they had a warm front going through central Pennsylvania today. And looks like that's the cause for a lot of the wind concerns, the wind shear. So we're definitely keeping an eye on radar there. I haven't seen a tornado warning yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if there's at least one before the night is through.
Yeah. Well, joining us tonight is someone else actually in Fort Collins right now. So she'll have the same weather, but joining us tonight is Stephanie Pilkington. She got her bachelor's degree in civil engineering from Virginia Tech. Then she got her master's from Colorado State. And right now she's working on her PhD there. She does a lot of work with predicting loss and communicating risk and vulnerability to the public for natural hazard events. We'd like to welcome to the show, Stephanie. Thanks for joining us. And I guess the weather's the same for you as it is for me. But what'd you think of the kind of chilly weather this morning?
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. I'm not a huge fan of the cold. I don't know why I'm in Colorado, but especially since it was, you know, the first frost this morning and I had to scrape my car a little bit.
Yeah, it's never fun.
So I could drive.
Yeah. So we'll get to your work in a bit. We're gonna talk about a few tweets here. Stephanie does some really interesting work with hurricane impacts and kind of a different kind of ranking system for them. So we'll talk about those in a bit. But to start, Tyler, take away our first tweet here.
Yeah, the first tweet comes from Jesse Farrell. He's a meteorologist at AccuWeather. He does social media there. And this is a current tweet. I figured why not put the current one right up at the top. It's a map of rotational tracks for storms in southwestern Pennsylvania. And there's two prominent storm tracks. One he references, and he says the southern storm took an east turn after leaving a trail of wind damage reports. That storm is, let's see, this tweet was 50 minutes ago, so it's probably a good ways east of here. But these tracks are south of Pittsburgh, and this is the weather that's moving through central Pennsylvania now. So, oh, Johnstown, good old J-Town. So in Winbur. So the storms are moving through the Allegheny Mountains, and in, as we said just a few minutes ago, wouldn't surprise us if there's a tornado warning, but we bring this up because it's in an area that we know pretty well, right? I mean, even though we're not there, it definitely catches my eye.
Yeah, I'm curious if this looks like the product that Matt Mihalik creates.
Oh, it might be. That's a good point.
It's weird that he didn't give a source, to be honest, but
it looks like it's a GR display. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I don't know. Huh. Well, but regardless, it's a cool product.
Yeah, and I'm looking at RadarScope in my right hand, and it looks like a lot of the storms are currently moving through. Yeah, they're east of Johnstown now, so the map is a little bit old. But anyways, yeah, there's rotation in some of the storms. The second tweet is from, oh, a guest on the show that we had, Ryan Breton. his tweet said, oh, he's a meteorologist at NH1 News in southern New Hampshire, and it says, New England's first snow of the season could come to the northern mountains this weekend. And there's a graphic on the tweet with lots of blue and pink over Vermont and northern New York, the Adirondacks, and up into Canada. And I haven't studied it personally, but I've seen model output that has a couple of inches in the Adirondacks. So
yeah,
the higher elevations could definitely have some great photos by the end of the weekend with the orange leaves and the snow. And of course, with the wind, I think peak foliage will be over for much of the region. But some good photos might come out of it.
Yeah, I saw a Snapchat that he sent. It said, I really don't want to have to tell people about this. You know, of course he knows he has to because it's the forecast, but doesn't really want to spoil their fall weather.
Well, the other challenge is for snow brings about requests for hype, and you know, when someone sees snow, it usually results in hype. So as someone who communicates the weather, it's difficult to tame down the expectations. A wet snowflake mixing in with 300 raindrops, you know, is not going to bring the plows out. So it's just getting into that rhythm. I mean, it's going to be last year we didn't get a lot of snow. So it's easy to say it's going to be a snowier winter, a colder winter. It'll be interesting to see just how bad the hype gets this winter. Can we go off the edge of the scale again?
Yeah. Well, best of luck, Ryan, with the first storm of the year. we'll move on to our next tweet here from Neil Milneal. You can follow him at Vigorous North on Twitter. He's a data journalist at thepresshale.com. You can tell that Tyler picked the tweets this week because this is another New England.
Hey, I thought about that, and I thought, you know what? If I'm picking the tweets, I get that advantage. And plus, they're high-quality tweets. What can I say?
No, it's fine. I'm just observing that, you know, it's a little of a northeastern
bias. No, come on. This is a fascinating tweet. Let's talk about it.
Okay, anyways. the tweet says, drought gets even worse across New England, and he gives a nice gif of the progression of the drought since late August up until now. And there's a few areas of exceptional drought, which is the highest level of drought. I'm wondering.
Yeah, I think it's extreme, but still it's very bad. Yeah.
No. Oh. Oh, yeah, you're right. It is extreme.
Yeah, the D4 is more D3. Like dried blood as opposed to fresh blood.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, so color scales here. So you guys are in a drought right now, and I don't know, how do you communicate a drought to viewers? It's not like sexy or anything or kind of eye popping.
It's not, I mean, I, it's not that bad. I think we, sometimes we get complaints that we don't respect the drought or we don't mention it, but it's not like we're going to say it every minute. I mean, you have to understand that a drought is not a 1 week thing. It lasts maybe a year or more. So if we harp on it every 5 minutes, it's, that's all we're going to talk about. So, there's been some complaints about that. We have some water restrictions in Connecticut. In Bristol, for example, the reservoir level dropped below 50%. And I got some great pictures and put and tweeted them the last couple of days. So it's definitely bad. It's the worst that we've seen in many years, I think since 2002. So more than a decade ago. And it's worse to the north and east of Connecticut. Part of the reason I chose this tweet is because I've never seen this guy on Twitter before, but the graphic fascinated me because it was, it's obviously the drought monitor, but it's not the graphic from the drought monitor website. So he designed that graphic. And then I looked at his bio and it says data journalist at pressherald.com. I thought, what a great idea. You actually have some high quality content coming out of what looks to be a local newspaper. I can only imagine. I mean, he must make a lot of different graphics that look like this, but it it's beautiful. It's so nice to see something that doesn't come from the same source. I mean, everyone tweets what's easy, but this is unique. And he has a graph on the edge. It says monthly rainfall. Very cool. I mean, the bars are the 2016, and then he has dots that show the average, and clearly the average for both Portland and Boston is much higher than what we've seen for months on end. So it just keeps adding up.
Yeah. Well, moving right along here, our next tweet is from Noah Bergeron. Bergeron? Yeah.
I think Noah Bergeron.
Bergeron. He's a they study meteorology. And I saw this from a number of people, actually. He tweeted out a video of undulatus aspiratus clouds going over some of the ridges in and really awesome gravity waves that set up there to produce some pretty awesome looking clouds.
Yeah, that's so a decent time lapse. Wonder how long the camera was sitting there.
Yeah, it must have been available to everyone because everyone just I saw everyone tweet it kind of at the similar time.
So like a shared, there was a pool camera on Walker Building.
Yeah, something like that because. Yeah, all at one point, everyone was tweeting it. Tyler, you want to take away this last tweet here?
The final tweet comes from the Weather Service in Seattle, and I chose this because we talked about the atmospheric river last week, and sometimes I think it's good to go back and see if it actually happened and see if the half hype comes true. The tweet is heavy rain the first half of the month for Western Washington. Some areas are already above the monthly October normals with half the month to go. Most notably, it appears probably, starts with an H. Hoquiam is probably a really bad pronunciation. But between October 1 and 16, they got over 10 inches of rain, and the October average is 6.5. So they definitely got a lot of rain in the Seattle area, the Seattle coverage area for the Weather Service in the last couple of weeks.
The bigger, it seemed to me, you know, the rain is a big deal for flooding and then subsequent landslide potential. But they got hit by a nasty, nasty windstorm.
They did. I was looking for wind tweets, and I couldn't find one quickly. But
there were even a few tornado warnings out there. There was a pretty dramatic video of a tornado.
Oh, that's right. An
EF2. Power flashes. Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty scary, but also really interesting weather that they had up there. Tons of power. Just I think it was. Actually, I don't know the number, but so.
That wraps up the Twitter segment,
this week. Thanks, Tyler, for putting those together with a little New England touch there.
No problem.
So we'll move on and talk with Stephanie here about some of her work that she's doing right now at Colorado State. So, Stephanie, let's start by getting kind of a an overview of how you got into weather and natural hazards. You have a degree in civil engineering, and 2 degrees actually in civil engineering. So that's not really the actually, you might be the first person we've had on the show with an engineering degree. So what kind of interests you about weather and kind of natural hazards?
Well, one of the jokes I like to tell students when I TA is that I specialize in death and destruction. So the civil engineering aspect is really what in my mind makes a disaster a disaster, because that's ultimately what the public sees it as. I mean, it's our infrastructure getting destroyed, it's our built infrastructure, it's like our buildings, our water systems, our transportation systems. And so that's how I see how that ties into natural disasters. It also, I picked it partly because when I was looking for a degree when I was entering undergrad, Hurricane Katrina had just happened. And I actually Googled who they sent down after Hurricane Katrina. And the most popular one was civil engineers. And I was also toying with the idea of building roller coasters, so that seemed like a nice merge. And that's kind of how I got into civil engineering, and then I just have since molded it more so around natural disasters since I got in the field.
Gotcha. And I saw from your Twitter bio that you chase storms.
Yes.
So you've kind of had this weather kind of passion just from observing it. I'd assume that kind of couples well with your degree and your research interest.
Yes, definitely. I grew up in New England, also in New Hampshire. We don't really see tornadoes, but for some reason, those always were my initial fascination. And it was funny because, you know, the movie Twister was obviously one I always watched when I was homesick. And then I went on a storm chase and I'm like, that's all wrong. my first storm chase was with Virginia Tech, a storm chase team there. And then I've gone out a couple times here in Colorado. It's super convenient living here in Fort Collins and just having to drive. Honestly, it's the same few roads every time I go, you know, back behind DIA, or sorry, the Denver International Airport. So that's always super convenient out here.
Yeah, I'm with you there. It is really easy. Just, what, 30, 45 minutes, you can get in a nice setup spot to chase some storms with relatively low traffic. Yeah.
Well, I was on a storm that had some pretty intense chaser traffic with it.
Oh, okay, yeah.
A couple years ago. And that was quite interesting. It felt a little bit like Oklahoma.
Yeah, chaser convergence is... Sometimes it's okay, but other times it's like, this is too much. So I want to talk about your scale here called the Hurricane Impact Level Ranking System. You actually had it published in the Journal for Sustainable and Resilient Infrastructure.
Yes.
Yeah. So kind of step us through what the purpose of this ranking system is compared to the Saffir-Simpson scale.
So as we're pretty much all aware, the Saffir-Simpson scale is mainly reliant on wind speed of an oncoming hurricane or a tropical cyclone. And the difficult part with that, as most people who work with natural disasters or natural hazards know, is that hurricanes aren't only a wind event. Hurricanes are huge flooding events. They bring rain, storm surge. And not only that, the impacts are drastically different depending on where they make landfall. For example, places like New York City are a lot more vulnerable to flooding because of their high urbanization. Whereas some places further south have some natural protective barriers like barrier islands that can actually absorb some of those hazards and minimize some of the impacts once it makes landfall. And so what got me going on this hurricane impact level ranking system was honestly Hurricane Sandy, because I was in New England around that time and everyone just kept saying, you know, oh, it's only a category one, it's only a category one, and trying to communicate to people that, you know, the storm surge they were calling for and the size of Sandy was going to make it a lot worse than they were thinking. It was actually kind of difficult. And it occurred to me that we need a way to bottom line it for people. The best thing to do is, you know, we keep trying to throw all these different hazards out at the public. And I honestly think the public just wants a bottom line. And one of the ways you can go about bottom lining it for a public is by looking at the amount of damage it will cause, because all of those hazards lead to the total damage. And so the hurricane impact level ranking system ranks hurricanes on their expected damage and then also gives a comparative hurricane for such an event.
Gotcha. And you have I'm assuming you have a model that projects the impacts based on kind of forecast you're using for that model.
Yeah, so the model, because all these variables they're pretty complicated in how they interact to end up contributing to damage. So the model we ended up going with actually uses artificial intelligence to do it. So we train an artificial intelligence program called Artificial Neural Networks using historical events with same parameters and a known outcome, so a known economic damage, to establish patterns similar to the way experts in the field learn. It's similar with like Sandy and other oncoming, and Hurricane Matthew, for example. What we were seeing, you know, we're seeing a lot of different variables go into that gut instinct almost that experts in the field have. And that gut instinct is actually based off of learned experiences. And so the artificial intelligence program actually attempts to mimic how the human brain would have learned those things. And so it allows us to use these multiple hazards and then connect them to an output that's a range of economic damage.
That's really cool. So I understand that part. What do you use like a GFS input to show like where certain winds will be and where maybe storm surge will be, or is that
The final model doesn't. We played around with multiple ways to input the data, and it was found that for this problem we wanted to minimize the number of inputs to the program. So we ended up just going with your basics. So your maximum wind speed at landfall, your minimum pressure at landfall, and these are all projected for a forecast using the system live. Also your expected amount of precipitation, storm surge, the latitude and longitude of landfall, and that's for up to 4 possible landfall locations. Because as you know, hurricanes can take some pretty weird tracks.
Matthew.
Yes, Matthew really tested this model.
Yeah.
And I have some others in the training set that just, I mean, I can't remember which one it is, but it went to Florida and then back around Florida and then like to the Carolinas. It was so weird. Yeah. And so it goes up to 4 of those. And then it also takes a population affected, which we take from overlapping the tropical storm wind radius with US census data. And so what that does, it lets us pull the total population out of the area that's encompassed by most of the storm. And by using the tropical storm winds, now that's not going to do much for your structural damage, but what that does capture are most of your rain bands. So that captures your heavy rainfall, specifically for cases like Hurricane Irene. We had a lot of damage due to flooding in Vermont. Now, Vermont obviously didn't see like the maximum winds from Irene, but they did see most of the rain. And when you overlap those wind radius with the population and captures those parts of Vermont. And so the population affected is meant to account for those.
So I have a ton of questions because this is really cool. one last question on like the inputs of the model or the parameters.
Yep.
How detailed is the infrastructure data?
Okay, so that's a question I actually get often. We explored adding in things like the ASCE, so the American Society of Civil Engineers, infrastructure grades. But what we determined is that, you know, since this, the beauty of using the artificial intelligence is that it learns. And so if I say to you something like, you know, New York City versus Nags Head, North Carolina, intuitively, you know the difference between how urbanized one is and how one isn't. And similarly, when we say things like maybe in Texas versus other areas along the Northeast, you know, one of those is going to have newer infrastructure and one of those won't. And those are kind of things that's just kind of learned. And so we tried just doing it without adding in more and more variables, which really almost create an issue with the accuracy of the model. And it was still able to learn, mainly because that's how we learn. And so that was kind of the beauty of using this program.
So we have a question here from Twitter, actually, from Alex Cole. Oh my gosh, Tyler, help me. He was our TA, and I can't remember how to say his last name.
Oh, I see. Alex Kowaleski.
Kowaleski, thank you. Sorry, Alex. he has a question for Stephanie here. And I'm going to follow it up, too. His question is there a way to assess the scale before a tropical cyclone impacts land? And then I was going to ask, as a follow-up, how did it do with Matthew?
So, yes, there is. We're currently testing its ability to do that now. So that's why you've seen my tweets. What we do is we give it those same parameters that we trained the model with. And most of this stuff I take from the public advisories that are issued. The National Hurricane Center also gives the shape files I need in order to pull the tropical wind radius and the population affected. I use the projected path for the latitudes and longitudes. So it's in using it real time, it is very dependent on the forecast. The model was trained with the actual data from historical events, mainly because those were the most accurate numbers. And forecasts can vary differently. There's no real consistency to how they so much vary. So we use the actual numbers, but then when you use it real time, what we have to use are the forecasts, the public advisories, the projected path, so on. And we can only really start using it as soon as all of those parameters are made available. And usually the last one made available is storm surge, because that's the last model that they're able to get out and run. And so it really depends on that and then whether or not it's been named a tropical storm yet or a hurricane, because they don't really issue those advisories until that happens. And then for Matthew, I can't really judge its accuracy completely yet because I can't judge their accuracy until the tropical cyclone reports come out in January. And that's when those total damage data come out, which then once I see the total damage data, I can put it within the ranking system.
Makes sense.
With Matthew, it was interesting because it was so varied on the path. It jumped from a impact level, I think right off the bat, it was a 2. And then it jumped initially right after the next advisory, it went to a 3. And then when the track then shifted more towards Florida, jumped up to a 4, and then it decided not to go that way and make landfall in South Carolina, and that brought it back down to a 3. So my hunch, and I don't know yet because we don't have the full numbers in, my hunch is that it'll probably end up being around a high impact level 3 event. It may even, with the continued flooding, hold at an impact level 4, But Matthew's going to be a great example for the model and how it's dependent on the forecast itself.
So this model that you have, who do you want to use this going forward?
I'm open to anyone using it who can communicate to the public in such situations, because I honestly created it with the hope that it was used along with the Saffir-Simpson scale so that it helped communicate the overall risk from an event. And the goal was that, you know, if you had something like, you know, let's say Hurricane Sandy, let's just choose some big names, and you could say it's a Cat 1, but it's an impact level 5 event. And the hope is with that, you're still bottom lining it for the public. And now you're communicating that, yeah, it's only a Category 1, but the impacts we're expecting from that are much, much, much higher than what that category is telling you.
So, go ahead. So this will be a real-time product that people can look at. You did say that there's no real-time model data going into it. Is that correct?
So yes, it will be a real-time product that can be used. The real-time data that, quote-unquote, real-time data that's going into it are when the advisories are issued by the National Hurricane Center. So it's not... Specifically, that would include
storm surge data from the Hurricane Center, not from a weather model.
Right, what the Hurricane Center issues.
So it combines the surge and the wind and all of that and spits out an impact level number or map. A map? Is it a map that it would put out?
It currently outputs an impact level number. I am working on how I would do that in a map, because the map would have to give gradated scales of the impact level, because you want to concentrate where you would see the most of that impact. And so that might be something slightly different, and we're still exploring that option and how we would put that in. The other thing is I need an awful lot of more GIS experience for that, because it'll involve overlapping a lot of... options, and I need quite a few more tools to get that done.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose right now the Saffir-Simpson scale is just one number, but when you look at different parts of the storm, obviously the northeast quadrant is the worst. And if you look at Matthew, the northeast quadrant stayed out over the ocean while it was near Florida, and obviously that long duration track in that position ultimately resulted in a surge in the, based on the, you know, just the shape of the United States when you get up towards the Georgia border. But I think it would be fascinating to see a map version of impact, because we have maps of wind and we have maps of surge, but if you put all those together, maybe you could come up with just an overall impact map. Anyways, continue on.
This is really cool. I'm kind of blown away, to be honest, because, you know, right now everyone is talking about how everyone's being very critical of the Saffir-Simpson scale, because it's one number and it's one number that doesn't actually take into account anything else but the sustained winds in the eye wall. And there are a handful of other scales that other researchers have developed to better kind of estimate the risk and the impact. So I think this is really timely work, and I look forward to seeing how it develops. And is there anywhere we could actually view this right now, or is it just kind of an internal product?
So the model itself is an internal product. I don't really have an outlet for the ranking system right now, except for Twitter, because I'm really just trying to get its exposure out there. I've also presented it at AMS to try and get its exposure out there as well. And then based on that exposure, is how it would develop, because I truly believe in it, in that its applicability in combining all the hazards into one clear and concise number.
And where do you kind of see the, you touched on this, but where do you see this model going? Like what kind of things will you add to it? And yeah, I guess that's it.
I mean, I really like to do the map. We're also looking at the possibility of maybe expanding on it for other hazards or in terms of resilience, community resilience, there's that too. And then, you know, you can also look at it, and maybe it has more applicability than just communicating loss to the public. Maybe it also can be used as a budgetary tool for local governments, you know, maybe for insurance plans, stuff like that. You know, if we say, you know, we're expecting this type of storm, what can we expect out of it? Similar to what they use now, which is FEMA's HAZ US, but this takes into account a few more things. The Florida public loss model for hurricanes actually takes more into account, and they developed that specifically for insurance purposes. But I mainly see it going into communication use, and I would love to be able to develop it into some sort of mapping, because I think people are visual, and maybe that's the engineer in me. engineers are always very visual, and I think presenting graphics to people makes everything a little clearer. And so I'd love to get it into a map form.
Absolutely. You've definitely captured my interest, and I just followed you on Twitter. And for anyone that listens to this, you are on Twitter at WXRiskChick. WXRiskChick. And since you said that that's how you plan on distributing some things, at least early on, that would be a good way to see how this progresses beyond the podcast. But something that we ask everyone that comes on the show is, what would your advice be to someone that is considering studying meteorology, or someone that is already studying meteorology but maybe struggling with that Calculus 3 class? What would your advice be to them?
So I'm trying to think of a way to put this not in engineering. we take a lot of the same base math classes, though, I've come to realize, and frankly, meteorology does a lot more of the intense math than engineering does. But what I'd say is, especially if you're in those first couple years and you're struggling with, you know, the maths, the physics you have to take, and the chemistry and all that, my advice would be that we've all been there, all of us, and it all seems so daunting the first 2 years. But in my experience, and this might be more of an engineering perspective, but once you get into the topics you're really interested in, it becomes so much more interesting. It becomes much more worth it. It doesn't feel like as much of a burden. And to be honest, once you actually get a job and are in the field you're working in, depending on whether or not you do research, the amount of that intense math you're feeling now is much less. And again, that might be an engineering perspective. I always found that the industry in engineering was shockingly so much easier than the undergrad curriculum made you think it'd be.
Well, thanks so much for that advice. I'm sure people will take that to heart. And thanks for joining us tonight and sharing your work. We really appreciate it. And I hope to have you on again sometime soon when we can see this in action once again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me, guys.
And that's going to do it for us tonight. But if you're not following us on Twitter, we're at the WX Junkies. You can also find us on Facebook. You can listen to this podcast on SoundCloud, YouTube, and iTunes. And if you're ever on iTunes, give us a rating or a review. We published a second podcast this week, part of the Weather Ready or Not series, meteorologist Becky Elliott from AccuWeather had a great, great podcast on Hurricane Sandy and some of the impacts they felt on the Jersey Shore. So if you didn't hear that, you can find it on our site or anywhere else, theweatherjunkies.com. It was a really good, really good listen, so give that a listen. Tyler, you want to send us off here?
Yes, next week we are excited to be joined by Brian Kahn. He is a senior science writer at Climate Central, so we'll have that live next Thursday at 8 o'clock. And of course, you can listen on demand when you have some time to do so. But thank you, Stephanie, for joining us this evening. And for Stephanie, Dakota, and me, we will see you right back here next week.